Welcome back, or welcome to the Developer Tribe, where we unpack the practices and processes of coaches, educators, developers, and beyond. We are at episode 11 of season 2, the penultimate for this season, talking to a bright young football coach with an interesting history in the game. Thanks for being here, however you got here, and with that, let's jump in. My guest today is an academy coach at Vålerenga IF in Norway, working with their under 14 players. He has a long history of achievements in the game, picking up under 16 cup winners in Norway, FA Cup winners in the Cayman Islands, and his OFC and UEFA A license and MS in performance coaching along the way. He's coached in Mongolia, Turks and Caicos Islands, Spain, the Cayman Islands, Norway and England. There's not many countries left to coach in. It's with pleasure I introduce Jack Brazil to the pod.
Hey, Dan. It's good to be on. It's exciting to speak about a few things and sort of delve a bit more into why I decided to do this, because I'm aware it's not the done thing.
Yeah,
sure. It's not a conventional route to being a coach. So I guess it would be interesting for me, for some people, to explain why I'm doing it this way.
Yeah, of course. Did I miss anything out?
Not that I remember. I mean, yeah. Just finished the UEFA A license. That would probably be the final part.
Oh, well, congratulations. Tell us, how old are you? You've been all of these places. You must be in your 40s, right?
27.
27.
Yeah.
So each of these places that you've been, presumably they've been for a year, 2 years at a time. How did that come about? And has that made things a little difficult for you?
Yeah. So the first thing, I guess, to sort of explain is that, for example, the first role that I took overseas was the Mongolia role. I was there for just over 2.5 months, and that was based on their season. So their season actually can only last for around 3 to 4 months due to the weather conditions that they have there. It's minus degrees for probably 4 to 5 months a year, all the way down to minus 40 if you're out in the and the countryside. So it's very difficult to play football. So then there's a futsal season that lasts quite a long time. And then I would, I came over for literally the league season. That was a really good experience and learned so much, particularly working through a translator and building relationships with people that you can't speak the same verbal language as. It was very, very tough, but I come away from there with some really good memories and some really good feelings. Similar experience in the Turks and Caicos Islands, where I took a team out to from my university. And we played some games there, and we played against their national team, we played against teams that were local to them, and then at the same time, all of the players in the team were doing some kind of community work. So I was coaching like the under-17 boys national team, some of the boys were working with the women's national team, and we had a really good thing there. So that was more a coach development thing for myself, to develop a group of, you know, university football players into both a team on the pitch but a team off the pitch, to really help develop the footballing program there. And that was really positive. And then the Gibraltar-Spain thing was tied in together. So we were coaching a Gibraltarian team to prepare for the Premier League season. So we took them through their pre-season program and everything. And that was based in Spain. So I was between the two when I was doing that, and we had a lot of Spanish players. So that really tested my non-verbal and verbal language skills again. Cayman was definitely more, a permanent fixture. I was there for just over 2 years. And that was, you know, astounding for me to be there for that long and learn how to really build a culture. And then I kind of learned from my mistakes a little bit when I came to Norway on how to build, and probably learn a little bit more about the culture that I'm coaching in, rather than going in a little bit headstrong as I might have done in Cayman.
So you picked up some of this learning along the way. As you say, it's an unorthodox journey that you've taken. What was the motivations for saying yes to all of these opportunities rather than perhaps staying with and growing with one club?
The main thing for me, and I always feel it, is those first 6 months to a year in a role where you're really out of your comfort zone, you develop so much. And I felt every time I went to a new place, the period, that first 3 months, was such a quick development period where I had to learn so much and become so much better. And as I've done more, that development period has actually gone on longer as I recognize more things that I need to do to be appropriate for the environment. So I might only consider originally when I moved to Mongolia, for example, oh, I'm just thinking about football and how does football look different. But then as I came to my next challenge in Turks and Caicos, I'm looking at the cultural differences in the people. And then when I'm coming to Gibraltar, Spain, I'm looking at demographic difference between the Spanish and the English that are playing in that league, and what do they live in? How do they travel to training? Can I have one size fits all rules for them? Because the reality is one of them comes in a car and one of them comes on a bus, and they haven't got the money to buy a car. So then how can I treat them all the same if one of them's late? It's not his fault. So then when I go to Cayman, even bigger. Now I've got age differentials. I'm coaching a 16-year-old in the same time as a 38-year-old. So the 16-year-old's coming from school and probably getting dropped off by his parents, whereas the 38-year-old has real control of his life, but also has kids himself. How do I then incorporate that dynamic within all these things? So it's been, like I said, the comfort zone is broke out of pretty easily in the first sort of instance, but then the more I went on, the more I realized there's so much more to learn and develop in these things. It takes almost a year for me now to really feel comfortable and develop myself into, and understand what is needed in these circumstances, what is needed in these environments based on what the different constraints and sort of contexts are.
You mentioned some differences in where your players are coming from and gaining an understanding of their context in order to be a more effective coach. How do you manage those tensions that might arise as a result of treating players slightly differently?
Trust me, it was really tough. And I think the main one that I can think of that was really difficult was in Cayman, the level was so different. So we'd have kids. I took one player to the MLS combine and he was like really, really good. Has had trials since with the USL clubs, been to the UK, played at a decent level there. And he was really good. But then in the same team, you'd have a guy that would struggle at Sunday League in the UK. So you had to balance that out alongside the demographics and the sort of all those little things that would go along with it. I guess a perfect way for me to illustrate how I dealt with them differently and would be that was one of the there was two boys on the team, brothers. I'm still in touch with both of them, great, great guys. And their mum, they had a single parent family. The mum worked in Subway and it wasn't the best paid job in the world. And she had four kids, so there was two younger ones as well as the two that played with me. They were 20 and 16 at the time. And they would come to training without eating and they wouldn't have food and things like that. And then I had to really think about it deeply. What was available? What could I get for them? So we would drive around to Burger King and I'd buy them what they wanted before training so they could eat. And it wasn't a question of, well, they shouldn't be eating burgers. It was a question of they need to eat. But then in the same instance, I'm having a guy turn up who's earning a six-figure salary working in a firm in the as an expat firm or an international firm. And I have to balance those people. And I think the leveler was always the football pitch. So I would be very similar when I was on the pitch with the boys, but off the pitch, I would have to explain myself almost. We didn't have a leadership group in search, but it kind of automatically formed itself, the key guys that had the strings. And I would just communicate very clearly with them about this is the way I'm doing things. If I'm harsh on you, this is why, and this is the relationship that I'm trying to build with these boys because they probably need me a bit more than you need me. And the boys really bought into it, and they were really, really good towards the end. And it got to the point where some of the more the boys that were well off and had a lot of money, they were buying boots, buying food, and bringing it, or they bring like the crate of water or Gatorade to the games. They understood it was their responsibility to also support the other kids. I remember one game we went to the Cayman Brac, another island, and one boy couldn't go based on the financial situation. His parents couldn't afford it. And one of the richer boys went, nope, I'm paying for it. Don't ever pay me back. It's fine. I've covered it. And we started to engender that based on communication and just explaining the situation to those key leadership people, and it kind of dripped down from them and became a discussion within the group, which was let's support each other. It was really, really quite powerful towards the end.
That social environment that you had, do you think the key to that was that you had been open and honest and given them a sense of awareness of how you were operating and that's why it trickled down? They were then able to follow suit?
And I think it was. it was clear to them I would, you know, I would go the extra mile for them if they needed it. I would pick them up. I would drop them off late at night if they didn't have ways to get home apart from walking. I would make sure that they were safe. And sometimes I would pick them up. If the session was at 6:30, I'd pick them up at 2 and they'd just sit at the training ground, or they'd come and help me with my earlier sessions. And they kind of felt like they were paying me back in that way. So we engendered this real club spirit where, and it did get to the point where we had to tell them to go home because they'd be there at 3 playing cards. They'd train at 6:30. We'd finish at 8 and they'd be playing cards until 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the clubhouse. And I had to turn the lights off and go home. And I'd just be sat there tearing my hair out. But I didn't want to stop it because at the same time, it's building something that sort of transcends football and it's bigger than it. And we're helping these kids to have something positive in their life. So that was a really special thing for me to start to appreciate. I can't treat everybody the same, you know, and even if, when it goes to the older players, we had players from Jamaica who were the most hardworking people I've ever met. And they weren't working for much money, if I'm completely honest, but in their eyes, it was a massive amount because they would send it back to Jamaica and it would be worth 10, 15 times it worth what it was worth in the Cayman Islands. So they'd support a whole family with that. And then I had to consider them at the same age as the people that were earning six-figure salaries, and you know, doing similar hours. And sometimes the Jamaican guys were doing even more hours to compensate for the family at home. And I then had to balance them out as well. And that was really tough sometimes because I couldn't treat them all with the same, you know, I couldn't paint them all with the same brush. I had to be really individual, and that led to some uncomfortable situations with people wanting to leave the club, being unhappy, not understanding it, and if they left, it was probably more often than not for the better because we got left with a core that understood what we were aiming to do.
Yeah, so the culture was more important than just those individuals. And with those differences and you being able to react a little better to those through those experiences, having learned how better to respond, how does that show up for you in your current role, which I assume is a very different environment to those you've described so far?
Yeah, different in that I'm working with younger kids, sort of 12, 13, 14 year olds. However, similar in that I'm still dealing with the same cultural issues. We have 32 players in our squad, of which I think 4 or 5 have 2 Norwegian parents. The rest have got at least 1 immigrant parent, or they are second or third generation immigrants to Norway. And that means that we have a lot of different cultures to deal with because at home they are treated completely different. You know, we have 4 or 5 Somalian kids. We have a couple of American kids, German kid, Danish, South American. We have a Bolivian, a Brazilian, we have French. You name it, there's probably a flag somewhere in the world in that country. And that's a special thing to have to deal with as well. And my experiences in Cayman have led to that. So, you know, we have one young man and I adore him. He's been getting the bus to training since he was 8 years old, and he lives 30 minutes away on the bus. And if he's late, I can't be so mad at him. I have to be really understanding with him and have a conversation based on why are you late in comparison to the kid who gets dropped off by his parents, or his parents are always there to watch him. That's a difficult minefield. At times to tread the line of, and because one of them is completely self-sufficient and the other one is dependent on his parents. The dependent on his parents will probably be on time because they live by their principles and allow that to happen, whereas the self-sufficient kid's really learning the world at 12 years old, and he's been doing that since he was 8. So you have to be patient, and I think that experience previously of not treating everyone the same has led me to here, where you have to understand everyone has an individual way of being spoken to, an individualized context on how to approach them within coaching, but more so off the pitch on a social aspect as well.
There's a couple of occasions there then with what you've described of some of the players you are working with and some of the difficulties that they're going through. You've described them almost as desirable difficulties, in so much as they have learned a lot through having to rise to those challenges with support from their families, from yourself, and obviously through themselves. On the other side of the spectrum, those players who have a more comfortable background don't have to fend for themselves in the same way. Do you find that there is a difference then in terms of you having to coach and perhaps having to produce some of those difficulties to challenge them?
I find it's a very well motivated group, regardless of what situations they have at home. They're very, very well motivated. They have really good approach to things. They enjoy being part of the team. The most motivated kid we have is probably the one that has the most supportive home background. And he's very stable, but he's so motivated and wants it so much. So I don't think there's a given rule. I don't think there's a yes or no. Or again, it comes down to, how do they look on the pitch? And they look very different. The kids who, this is the irony of it, the kid who has stable home life, everything's okay for him, very comfortable. He takes responsibility for himself. He's learned to get himself to training. He wants to do it now, and he has that attitude. Whereas the boy who's been coming to training at 8, they play next to each other on the pitch, and they have a really good relationship and way of being, and they have an excellent personality sort of opposition, in that one is very creative and he's the one who's looked after himself and he's had to find ways of doing things. And there's the one who's had a very comfortable and he listens and he understands to rules and responsibilities and he does it really well. So they make this really brilliant blend as a pair in the positions that they play. And I think it does lead to that when you're left to your own devices and you don't have a phone because you don't have the money for it, you don't have a PlayStation because your parents can't afford it, you are sat there usually with a book, a piece of paper or something like that that's affordable. How do you create fun? And then it leads to this creative mindset when they're on the pitch. And then you have the kid who's grown up with everything that he needs. And he has this rules and regimented way, and he asks all the questions and he wants to learn more and he has a real desire for information. He's, it's a really, really interesting conundrum to have at times and to sit and break it down. And you do have to treat them differently, but they can, at both ends of the spectrum, have really strong motivations.
Yeah, perhaps their whys come from different places, but clearly you have a great awareness of players' context, something you've taken seriously in terms of developing and maintaining the coach-athlete relationship as part of your coaching process. At least that's what I'm hearing. How have you developed your own self-awareness and the ability to pick up on those things and be able to respond to those flexibly?
Yeah, it probably started in Mongolia. I remember it was the first morning and we were going to have training after I'd landed, and big time difference. I'm completely wiped. I've slept about 3 hours due to jet lag. I'm in pieces physically, mentally. I'm like, what the hell have I done? I've landed in a country where I don't speak the language. I've got, a bad stomach based on the food that I've been eating because it's got different, complete different bacteria. And I had this sobering moment of, I'm in the owner's car or the coach's car, whatever you want to call him. He was the be all and end all of the club, a great, great man. And he came and picked me up. And I thought this apartment I was in was pretty grotty. I remember it. I'm sitting in here like, what am I doing in here? Like, this is like odd. It was just odd. It was very different. It wasn't what I was used to. But I was in a nice apartment building, very old fashioned. So I get picked up. Did you sleep okay? Not really. I'm struggling. Explained my problems, and he sort of laughed and just kept quiet and didn't say anything. And we kept driving, and I'm thinking, are we going to the training ground? So we're going to the training ground. Yeah, but we have to stop off and get a couple of the players. And we stopped off at, I don't know if you know what a yurt is or a gird. It's a tiny little hut, and this boy gets out, and he is tiny, quite malnourished, very skinny, and has a full, he has a Rooney Man United kit on, and his family start appearing out, and there's so many of them that live in this little tiny place. And it was a sobering moment for me to go, I'm so selfish and I don't understand, the context of all these people. And we went to another guy and did the same. And then there was another kid who turned up driving to the session, and he had his own car and he had a nice stable job. And I think that was my first moment where I went, okay, I really need to start focusing on this, because while the pitch might be a leveler and I can coach them pretty similarly on the pitch, there'll be little differences. I need to really understand them off the pitch and where they come from. And I think that lent itself into when I went on to my next roles. I always had that first morning image in Mongolia of where do these guys actually come from? And then because I don't have it was just by chance that we went to pick this kid up. He would sometimes catch 3 hours worth of buses to come to training. And it just was by chance I experienced that morning. And now I think about it when I see my players, I'm not going to go and do that. I'm not going to pick them up. They're 12, 13, 14, highly inappropriate. However, how can I glean that information from them and learn about them in one-to-one conversations and it be organic? So it's before the session, it's after the session. Some kids just want to sit around and chat after the session. Some guys even say in the session, oh, I did this with my brother today. It was really cool. And you start to, well, what's your brother's name? How old is he? What school does he go to? Oh, he has a job. What does he do? And you start to build these pictures of the kids, and then it's down to you almost committing it to memory and building those relationships. Next time he comes, how's your brother? What's he doing? How's his job going? Have you seen him recently? And then the picture becomes clearer and clearer of, this is what this kid deals with on a daily basis, and how can I contextualize my approach to him or her?
You said they're committed to memory. Is it a cerebral process in which you are storing that information about these players and then responding, or is there a planned process to how you keep track of the different contexts to these players' lives?
It started off as being quite a planned process of me having, one-on-one conversations, organizing them, and I almost had a set of questions in my head and what does home look like? What does this? And it almost became forced, and it became a little bit fake. So then it was me starting to scale it back and make it feel like to the kids, they're not being interviewed, they're not being interrogated about their home life. What is happening here is I'm just taking an interest in what they do and how they are, and it's an organic conversation. And then it's down to me whenever they tell me these things to just think about it clearly. And as I've gone on, these skills have become a lot easier for me because now I just remember it. I pick it up. Oh, this player's got two brothers. One's older, one's younger. These are the names, and this is what the parents do for a job. So now I have a basic understanding of, well, this is probably what the kid's home life looks like. And it might be that I don't revisit it for 2 or 3 weeks. Oh, so what do you do when you go home? Like, do you read? Do you play PlayStation? Do you hang out with your parents? Oh, they work, do they? They work late. Okay, so you hang out on your own with your brothers. Does your older brother look after you? Oh, he's usually at boxing, but. And then I start to build these pictures of, so this is probably what their home life looks like. And this starts to explain a lot of the behaviors when I'm trying to coach you, why you might be quite submissive and listen and be, yeah, okay. Or you might be a little bit resistant sometimes when you make a mistake to my feedback because you've got your parent always on your back who's telling you what you're doing right or wrong and is micromanaging you. And then I start to create that almost spectrum of, well, what do they have? What don't they have? Where do they fit on this spectrum? And how can I contextualize my approach based on that?
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to go with this. What's the point? Having gone through academia as you have and coaching courses, we are told that coach-athlete relationships are vital to effective coaching. For you, what is the point of those relationships and building them, maintaining them? How does that affect your day-to-day coaching in training or match days? Can you give us a bit of a sense of what that looks like?
It looks like me building a picture of what they experience in their lives, what they are as people deeply, not just, oh, I know he likes to listen to this music. Like, actually, what does he experience day to day? And how does that link into football? And how does that link into the environment? And then I know for some kids, this is the be all and end all for them. They will look at every week and they will have on their calendar, I have 4 sessions on these days and I'm so excited for them. This is going to be brilliant. And so for those kids, I can push the hell out of them and they love it. And they think, like, this is cool. The coach is engaged with me. He wants me to do this. He gives me all this feedback and they're so engaged. And then there's the kids where kind of being good at football has just been a byproduct to them of hanging out with their friends. And then I have to be more intelligent with the way I speak to them. Yes, they might be really intrinsically motivated to be the best they can be, but the priority for them when they come to training is, I want to see Dave, Steve, Pete, I want to see all my friends and hang out with them and have a giggle. And football is kind of a byproduct of that. So then I have to think about my context in the session. So I started to build it up that the first 40, 50 minutes is what we kind of call the coach time. And that's how I say it in my head, is that's when I'm going to teach you, and I'm going to put things into you, and I'm going to make you feel like this is something that can develop yourself as an individual, and put those ideas into your head. And then those last 30, 40 minutes of the session will be a lot freer. You'll play games, and the games will be a set period of time, maybe 6 minutes to however many. And then in the individual breaks, if you want to go and have a drink, disappear and go and have a drink. If you want some feedback, I'll be stood on the pitch and we can have a chat about it. But I'm leaning it then into, I lead the first 50 minutes. This is almost our time to develop you and my time to work with you. And then after that, it's your time to show what you can do. And if you want to use it in another way, you can. But if that 50 minutes is enough for you, it's more than enough for you. And then we step back and almost let you have whatever format of games we plan for that day. And hopefully those format of games links to the coach time almost.
I'm curious as to why you're operating that way around. You know, there's other ways of coaching, whole part whole, more games-based approaches. What is it about implementing more coach time, as you put it, in those first moments of sessions and then going freer? Why that way round?
I think right now with where I am with this group, I took them over in November. So this is about, because we had a long break, we had almost a month out with the winter break. And this is my reflection, this part now is for me setting the standards on where we need to be. And by reminding them every session, they hopefully become almost automatic, and hitting them as early as possible with those demands and those standards and the way we work and the way things go. And then we can start to see other ways of doing things. You know, an example in Cayman, we would put out a rondo, and as the kids arrived, they could just play the rondo and they would just go and join in. And then we build a second one. And that we wouldn't even do a warm up. There won't be a physical warm up. They do some kind of fun rondo activity, and then we go into like a simple practice where they'd lead it, and then they do a warm up associated with it before we started. So 25 minutes into the session, I've had very little to say or do. It's just been driving the tempo and standards and letting them, you know, do a warm up, and it works really well there, because I think a lot of those guys were quite mentally fatigued, or they were tired from the school, the environment that they've been in. Whereas schools here, and this is a bit of a generalization, some kids are in different levels of schooling, it's quite free. They get a lot of choices, they get a lot of freedom to do as they want, and it's a nice schooling system in that they have a lot of decisions to make themselves as kids, and they get to choose almost what they do a lot of the time. Yes, they have math, English, Norwegian, science, but they also have a lot of freedom that we don't have sort of in, I guess, UK education that I experienced. So when they come to football, creating that structure for them in the first 40, 50 minutes isn't so much of a problem. And I think as it goes on, I might be able to move that structure back a little bit and let them maybe have the first 15, 20 minutes to themselves to get used to things, socialize, you know, and start to build some ideas themselves. But I think right now, and this is the purpose, it's building the standards, building the culture, building the way we want to work. And then as that's, you know, I always see it as like a fist, start really tight, and then you can release. But if you start loose, it's very hard to get that fist back in tight. So it's thinking of those sort of contexts.
Sure. Clearly there's a cultural reason for why you are strategizing that way. It's fascinating. You're obviously a young coach, despite having had so many experiences. Do you have any advice for newer coaches, those entering the pathway now?
Yeah. So I started at 16. My start point was my friends were getting picked up by clubs. I'd always had the impression probably from 14 onwards that I wasn't good enough, but you let yourself dream. And at 16, I told my dad that I wasn't that good, and he was involved in football, so he put me on my level one, and I did that, and I actually started to really enjoy it, probably by 17, 18, a lot more than playing. And then it was about testing myself and taking myself out of my comfort zone. So if then I'm going to apply that to coaches that I know coming up, it's find things that make you a little bit nervous, make you scared, make you feel inferior, and go and try those things. And I'm not saying apply for a UEFA pro license job if you've just got you level one. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying sort of culturally, if it's, you know, if you see a job advertised in the Middle East and you think, I think, you know, you fit the qualifications, there's no reason why you shouldn't go for it and try it and really give yourself an opportunity to be out of that comfort zone for those 6 months and learn different things. You know, and I would fully advocate going and, you know, finding out about different cultures, finding out about how you can affect them, finding out how you really work in an environment which doesn't have as much judgment as maybe you would have in a professional academy in the UK, for example, where you have a head of coaching, you have an academy manager, and things are very structured. Going to these other countries, almost where you get given a project and you get on with it, really, really good to develop who you are and understand the different way to work. And a way to work that really suits you as an individual and your personality type.
Yeah, I resonate with that heavily. I spent some time in Saudi Arabia and went out there working for Arsenal, and that fitted nicely with my opinions on effective coaching practice and with the kids that we had on program, as they hadn't had much in the way of organized practice prior. It was working well. The organisation then got taken over by Juventus, who have a much more structured way of doing things, many more isolated technical practices as part of the curriculum and session design. And I hadn't delivered that way for some time. And certainly those first 2 or 3 months was really challenging. And the challenge about it is, well, what of my principles and values still fit, even though it's a different approach? Does that connect with you?
Yeah, exactly. And I entirely agree that you have all these different ways of doing things, but how can you then tie them into your personality and the way of doing, and the way you're working and the way you're coaching? I find one thing that was really difficult in Cayman was I'm quite energetic. I'm quite lively on the coaching pitch. I don't like to be quiet. I don't want to be a part of, you know, like a background part. I like to be involved in everything and almost be one of the players in the way I speak and communicate with people. I don't want to be above someone, but I like to be, feel like I'm part of that. And the way I do that is explaining and being energetic and pushing people and being really lively. One of the things I found really hard in Cayman was it was 30 degrees most days. So to then push people for an hour and a half, bloody hard for them. And then pressing high, that was what we wanted to do, was a luxury, because you're only going to be able to do it for so long before the body gives out. And that's not just, you know, that's not just me saying it. It's not psychological, it's physiological. There's only so much you can do in that heat and that temperature. Add in the fact that a lot of these guys didn't have much money, couldn't afford Gatorade, couldn't afford water. You know, we're coming dehydrated on the back of poor dietary habits, all those things. It made it really tough. So then I had to think about, well, how can I make this really energetic and lively within the constraints of what we have and the context of what we've been given here? And, you know, that then was me finding that new way, almost as you did with Juventus, with those isolated practices. How can you still make that mirror your coaching personality and the way you are and what you demand from people, even though it's slightly different maybe to what you idealistically would like to do?
You mentioned a couple of times there tying it into your personality, and the word that came up for me whilst you were talking is authenticity. Why is that important to you?
It's just something that you have to believe in. I feel it's something that I want to be, you know, and it's something that I identify with. And then when I'm on the side of the pitch and I'm coaching, I'm with the boys on whatever we're doing. I'm not conflicted by, do I actually agree with this or not? That's kind of where I go with it, and it's almost a settling feeling within myself that I'm not opposing my own values. I have my values, I have the way I want to do things, and I would like my teams to you know, identify with that themselves, and the players to recognize that, and we work together towards a mutual goal of where we want to be. And I think if I sell it the right way, it becomes the players' way of doing things as well, and they really want to do it and they enjoy it and they become part of it. And it was something we really did well in Cayman. We came with a completely different system. We played a 4-4-2 diamond, Nobody played it on the island, and we were tearing teams apart because they didn't know how to deal with a full central midfielder. And we had the complete perfect positional sort of type in the wing back position. And we had two really good strikers, one creative, one would run in behind. And it just worked really well. And it was really difficult to deal with. But the thing that we struggled with in that shape was the defensive aspect of how do we turn this into a defensive shape? And we committed to pressing high and being really, really aggressive and trying to win the ball back. And then hope if it got played over, we would find a solution in a block of how we were going to defend it. And that was really difficult. And it demanded a lot of the players, particularly the side of the diamond. But it was real to what we wanted to achieve in that we were younger, we were a bit rough and ready, we weren't in the best financial position, we weren't in the best physical condition, we didn't have the best diet. But what we really had was when it came to it, we worked harder than any of the teams, and we really identified and were proud of that. And doing it with young players, and it linked into everything that was about that young energy, lively, you know. Even though things weren't quite our way, we were going to find a way to do things. And it all linked really nicely that we would be a bit innovative with our shape. And, you know, that the players bought into it, I bought into it. It made it authentic to me of came away with a lot of learning, a lot of different, you know, experiences based on the fact that energetic, innovative, and different.
Even at the formation level of how we operate as a team has contextual constraints, the external variables impacting how you've operated there. So yeah, it irritates me when speaking to some coaches saying, "Oh well, I play a 4-3-3." Okay, always, regardless of your team, their attributes, their team dynamics, the opposition, it feels more important to me that there's some flexibility to a game model of principles that still fits regardless of formation. So when I've had situations working for franchises saying we play this formation regardless of context, it doesn't make sense to me. With your current role at Vålerenga, have I said that right?
I mean, I called it Vålerenga until I was here for probably 6 months. Is the ah with the circle on the top is an oh, so it's Vålerenga. But I still can't pronounce it, and I butcher it every time I say it, regardless.
All right, well, thanks for letting me off. What's the biggest challenge facing your role there at the moment?
Biggest challenge is we're not dependent on the academy, but we have a lot of academy players in the first team, so there is a pressure to develop them. We got given the first 5-star rating as an academy at the start of 2020, the back end of 2019. So it was a big achievement for us, and now we have to start to consider where does this leave us? Because yes, you want to produce players for the Eliteserien and the top division in Norway, where our first team plays, and we have, you know, probably five or six stable players in the first team that are from our academy. That's really positive. But then the reality is for them to achieve what they really can achieve by 19, 20, 21, we want to be looking at selling them to the next place and getting to the next destination. So that would be the big challenge, is we're not just preparing them to be the top level of the game that they can play in this country. We want to make them top level European internationally, and without having the competition in everyday games that can lead us to that level, it's really hard. Young ones, it's okay because you can play up here, and we do that quite substantially, and we get hurt, we get beat quite a lot. So there might be some coaches from other teams listening thinking that I'm completely mental, and thinking that I'm talking complete nonsense because they've beaten my team 7-0, which is a completely understanding thing to have. It's a constant an understanding opinion. But we hope by doing this model, the long term, when they get to 17, 18, they have an understanding of how to play against the larger team. They have an understanding of how to play against better players. They have an understanding of space, time, how to work in these areas. And then if they drop, we drop them into a Dutch league, you know, a French league, a Portuguese league, you know, they would have an opportunity to really, really, really shine, and they could come to the top. And that's the big challenge that faces us. We're not just producing players for the top level in our country. We're producing players for a higher level than that. That's our hope. That's our dream. And I think it's a lot of the kids' dreams as well. Yes, they want to play for the first team, but then they also have, I'll play for Bayern Munich one day. I want to play for PSG. I want to play for Barcelona. And we have to be cognizant of that.
Fantastic. Lofty aims, and rightly so. It sounds like the club has had a decent history so far, and I'm sure that your involvement will help in getting closer to those aims. Jack, thanks so much for your time today. A last question for you. If you could have an audience with just one person, who would you choose?
My hero, Jurgen
Yeah, why him?
Klopp. He gets the social side. He gets the cultural side. He's gone to Dortmund. He's gone to Liverpool and created something that might be slightly foreign to him, being from a, you know, yes, he grew up in Germany, but he wasn't Dortmund born and bred. And the same with Liverpool. He's understanding the culture. He's understanding the way of being, and I really enjoy that element of it. And moving around and seeing different things. So I'd love to pick his brains on how does he do that? Does he intentionally do it? Is it something that he just, he's a social chameleon. Does he pick up the traits and work out how to do it himself and start to dig a bit deeper into that element? Because I think that's the essence of creating a team. And then the rest of it comes around that. And the rest of the tactical, the physical, the technical, they come around the building of the team emotionally. Culturally and the way we want to work, and that almost takes an identification from the coach of where we want to take them. And I think he's probably the most successful in the world at doing that right now.
Well, if it's okay with you, I'm jumping in on that meeting to hear your questions and to pose about 100 of my own. If anyone was to reach out, what would be the best way to find you?
Yeah, feel comfortable to reach out to me on Twitter. It's at JackBraz29. And that's usually the best place. That's the one I monitor the most. So yeah, feel free to contact me there.
Superb. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation, so thanks again. And just leaves me to say, welcome to the tribe.
Thank you very much. And yeah, it was really enjoyable.
That's it for episode 11 of season 2. My thanks to Jack for giving up his time and insights on a busy and full burgeoning career. The music you are listening to is by BB Phoenix, details in the description. There's some exciting things coming from the developer tribe in the not too distant future, so keep your eyes peeled for that. And of course, for our last episode of season 2 next week that we look forward to having you back for.